This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Victims of the Holocaust used many strategies to cope with the overwhelming horror. Writing was one of them. It may have been of some comfort to those who experienced it, and the writing that survived is valuable to the rest of us. The most famous voice from the Holocaust is that of a young girl, Anne Frank. At 15 years old, she wrote, "I still believe, in spite of everything, that people are truly good at heart." It's hard to believe that anyone, even a child, can be so big-hearted. Less well-known is the voice of an adult woman, Etty Hillesum, and her writing is finally getting its day in the sun. My next guest is Susan Stein. She's a writer and actress who's bringing Etty to life in a one-woman play. It's going to be performed at the Jewish Community Center in Durham this Sunday, March 17th at 4 o'clock. Susan Stein is with us now. Welcome to the show. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Who is Etty Hillesum?
Etty Hillesum was a young Dutch diarist who began these diaries in 1941. She was 27, and she suffered with pretty severe depression and thoughts of suicide. So Holland's already been occupied in 1941, although she doesn't talk about that right away. But she begins therapy with Julius Speer, who was actually a student of Jung's. And upon his encouragement, she begins this diary as part of her therapy. What happens is, because she has literary aspirations, the diary takes off and has a life of its own. And the diary has, you know, is surfacing now in ways that it hadn't before. It took 40 years to get the diaries published. And I have thoughts about that. But the diaries and letters have resonated with people all over the world.
Literary and other aspirations. She wanted to go to law school. She wanted to be a judge.
No, she went. Yeah, she wanted to be a judge when she was a girl. She actually had a law degree.
Yeah,
that's what she did. And then when she finished that and had graduated, she realized she didn't want to do that, and she switched gears and decided to move to Amsterdam and study Slavic languages. And she was an older student and was tutoring Russian up until she couldn't do that anymore because of the Nazi measures.
So here we already have a much more a complicated and mature person than we would have in the person of Anne Frank, someone who is going through therapy at the time. She's at one time planned to be a judge, now is working as a writer and as a teacher. So what you said that she didn't talk much about the Nazi occupation. What was she writing about early on?
She's writing about herself. Yeah. She's got some demons, and she's trying to work through those. She wants to understand herself. She has a fear of schizophrenia. Her two younger brothers suffer with that. She's trying to uninhibit herself. She calls it spiritual constipation that she's trying to kind of rid herself of. When she brings up the occupation, actually the first time she brings it up in the diaries, she brings it up in an interesting way. She talks about how hatred is poisoning everyone's souls. And so she's actually more like Anne Frank than different. I didn't read Anne Frank's diaries again while I was working on the script. I waited until I had a full script. But when I read them, and I was meeting Anne for the first time because I had read her censored, abridged diaries. And so now that you can get the full Anne's diaries, I realized that Anne also was complicated and sexual and, more of a woman than I think I had met when I was 12. But Rachel Brenner at the University of Wisconsin writes about how Anne Frank and Etty are both products of the Enlightenment. And they are. And they're both holding on to that world in Europe, even though Europe is not really holding on to it itself. Anne and Etty are both young women. They're both great writers. They both refuse to demonize their perpetrators. They're both committed to believing in the goodness of people. Where Etty is different because she's inside and Anne is in hiding, is Etty understands that a machine has taken over. And that the Germans, the Jews, and many other groups have gotten caught in this machine, and that the machine has to play itself out.
That's her understanding of the world around her. And as you say, she's also struggling to understand the world within that she finds frightening, and that psychoanalysis is beginning to awaken a spirituality that she finds entwined with her sexuality and sensuality. And maybe you could give us a performance now, a reading that would demonstrate some of what's happening with her at this time.
Speer's mouth looked so dear and close this afternoon that I had to brush it softly with my lips. He did not kiss me, but gave my cheek a powerful nip and asked shyly, almost painfully, "What about my mouth? Didn't it put you off?" "That's where his weak spot is, then." Then he said again, "But one's mouth ought to be smaller." And he pointed to the right side of his lower lip, which protrudes in an odd way from the corner of his mouth, curving thickly, a piece of lip that seems to have got out of control. "Have you ever seen anything so willful? There's nothing like it." I don't remember his precise words. And again, I brush my lips over that obstinate little piece of mouth. I don't want to have an affair with him, though things are fast moving in that direction, but I don't want it. His future wife is in London, lonely and waiting for him. And I, too, have a relationship, after all. I love Han. Speer dug up God in me, the deepest and best part of myself, which, for the sake of convenience, I call God.
Susan Stein giving us a performance. What is her, or what had been her relationship with God? You talk about her being a product of the Enlightenment. She was Jewish. Was she close with her religion? Did she practice before all of this?
No, she's a highly assimilated Jew. Her father is a classicist, and she's quite close with her father. She really reveres him. He was the principal of a school and taught Latin and Greek. She's studying the Quran. She has the New and Old Testament with her. She quotes Matthew a lot. She keeps St. Augustine under her pillow. She brings the Quran with her to Auschwitz. So she practiced Buddhism, but she does identify herself as a Jew. And that's another way she's like Anne Frank. She doesn't deny that. She doesn't deny her ancestry. She also connects with the suffering people, and I don't think she would have in any way denied that connection. She has, you know, I love that line, Speer dug up God in me. And I have to say in this project working with this that Eddie has dug up God in me. That's been the hardest work, I think, in the project because I didn't know I was going to have to work on God. But as the work was going on, I realized if I didn't get that right, an audience would spot it in a second. And young people in particular, students, will talk to me about the prayer and the conversation with God being what resonates the most for them, which really surprises me.
You performed this in prisons as well as schools and other venues, and you have said that that is where you have the most profound experience and get some of the deepest reactions to this show.
I started performing in prisons in September, and I brought it to the largest women's prison in the United States, MCI Framingham outside of Boston, in November, and I just came back from a tour of prisons in Scotland and some in London. And I'm going back. I'll be bringing it back to prisons in Scotland and London in May. The inmates have opened their hearts to Eddie's words and taught me a way of understanding her that I don't think I had seen before. When I brought it to... I had two performances at MCI Framingham. One was for women who will get out, and one was for lifers. And as I was walking through the different buildings and courtyards, and it was at night, that performance, to get to the chapel where the performance was, I was aware that that some of the women will die there. And I understood that Eddie also understands that she will most likely die. I mean, she doesn't want to die, but she, you know, understands that she will. And the inmates understand, even though they're very clear that their experience is completely different from hers, that their thinking about mortality and freedom is different than mine, and they've helped me see that. I got a letter in the mail from one of the inmates. This is from an inmate in London. She says, "Thank you for your inspiring depiction of Eddie. As I said during the discussion, it was a bittersweet, honest, and poignant representation of the human condition. Beautiful, thought-provoking, and life-changing. One woman's struggle with depression, sexuality, prejudice, and moral conundrums. It forces the audience to evaluate themselves whilst accepting that each and every one of us is human, precious, and sadly capable of actions which, despite the intention, rationale, are questionable." She had said to me after the performance, because we always have a discussion, and at the prisons they usually leave us at least an hour for a discussion, that she didn't want to come that morning. She had signed up and she thought, "I really don't want to be here." And I looked at her and I said, "That's exactly how I felt this morning." And, you know, she laughed, and then she said that this changed my life. She had never heard a woman's internal struggle in the way that Eddie writes about it. And I think that was my experience reading her diaries.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about her biography as well to come to an understanding of just what she was struggling with. She went to Auschwitz and eventually died there. Not much of her writing, I understand, survives from Auschwitz, but she was at a transition camp, and that's where we get much of what survives and what's published. Am I right about that?
She leaves all the diaries through October 1942 in Amsterdam when she leaves Amsterdam the final time. And in one of her final letters to her friend Maria, she says, "If I don't come back to get these diaries to Klaas Smielek, who has a radio program, and thinks that maybe he can do something with them." And he tries during his entire life. It's his son, who also has the same name, who actually did finally get them published. Her privileged position allows her to write letters from Vesterbork. And those letters are what we have from October 1942 on. And because her world is Christian and the people she's writing to are off the radar, those letters survived. And two of her greatest letters, became part of the Dutch resistance. She did not know that, but she refers to them as pieces of journalism.
And you talked about Vesterbork, and that, of course, is the transition camp. So she's
right
in and out of this camp. And
right,
she writes and demonstrates a remarkable sympathy or empathy toward her persecutors. And maybe you can perform another excerpt for us that will demonstrate how she felt about this. Because you talked about this machine that she realized everybody was caught up in, even her captors.
"On Tuesdays, the train leaves. The call-ups come in the middle of the night, a few hours before. The quota is not yet filled. A few young women are already sitting in a freight car. They hold their babies on their laps, their legs dangling outside. They are determined to enjoy the fresh air as long as possible. A guard with an enraptured expression is picking purple lupins, his gun dangling from his back. More and more people are filling up the spaces. 6 o'clock in the morning has arrived. The train is about to depart at 11. The nature-loving policeman has gathered his purple bouquet. Perhaps he's off to court some farmer's daughter. The engine gives a piercing shriek. The whole camp holds its breath. Another 3,000 Jews are about to leave. There are babies with pneumonia lying in the freight cars. The doors have been sealed, but a plank has been left out here and there, and people put their hands through the gaps and wave as if they're drowning. I need to speak to you alone. Is that all right? Your lessons are hard, God, I am almost proud that you do not keep your last and greatest mysteries from me.
Susan Stein performing from Eddie, a one-woman show that she will perform at the Jewish Community Center Sunday, March 17th at 4 o'clock. Is there any evidence, do we know, that because when she talks about that policeman, the nature lover, there's not a hint of irony in that. She's not. She sees this guy as somebody who loves flowers. And elsewhere, she imagines an officer, I think a camp guard, picking flowers for his girlfriend. Am I right about that?
Yeah, well, I think she continues to imagine that guard and think about him. And I think she turns him into a lover. I mean, she's a lover, and she turns him into a lover. It certainly says more about her than him. It's interesting. I was at a school in Maine, and the principal came up, lovely man. He came up enraged. That line that you bring up always gets a response. And he came and said he was so enraged at that guard. How could he be picking flowers while this freight train is going? And yet Eddie doesn't see him that way. She has another line I want to share with you that speaks to something you said before. This line always gets a response, particularly in the prisons. It's in the play. She says, "If an SS man were to kick me to death, I should nevertheless look into his face and wonder, my God, you poor fellow, what terrible things must have happened in your life to bring you to this pass."
It's remarkable to me that all of this, which could sound like cheap grace, be kind to your captors, turn the other cheek, the responses you get are anything but, and people empathize with her, I guess precisely because you convey the difficulty and the struggle that she had finding that place. It didn't come from a Hallmark greeting card.
Wow, thank you for saying that the way you did. Yes, I wouldn't have articulated it that way. She believes that the problems in the world are the problems in her own heart. She writes in her diaries, it's not in the play, she says, "Nazi barbarism evokes the same kind of barbarism in ourselves, one that would involve the same methods if we could do as we wanted here and now. We have to root out that barbarism within us, root out the hatred within us." She feels that the first and most important step in helping the world is to help her own heart, that that's what she needs to do. And there's a great quote, I'll have to send it to you, and they were thinking of actually putting it on Churchill's statue, but it didn't make it. Another quote got there instead. But it's about learning that. If there's anything we've learned from this war, and I think that's, if there's a reason it doesn't go towards Hallmark card, I think it would be the truth of that for her, because that is, you know, that is what she's committing herself to.
What has this done for you?
I'm not sure I saw the hatred in my own heart until I started working on this. I certainly didn't take responsibility for it. I'm someone who blames, and I feel awfully justified in doing that. I think she's taught me to kind of see, okay, what's my part. She says, and this is always remarkable to me every time I read it, she says to God, "You cannot help us. I shall have to help you, God." My difficult situations are pale in comparison to hers, and yet I seem to always ask for help. And the idea of going to a place or being in a place where she takes responsibility for God, I've just begun looking at that. What would that look like? I mean, what would that look like if in the middle of even hell where she is, that we take that responsibility?
Susan, it's remarkable. Thank you so much for being on this program.
Thank you.
Susan Stein wrote and performs the play Eddie. It'll be staged at the Jewish Community Center in Durham this Sunday, March 17th at 4 p.m. and at the North Carolina Stage in Asheville, April 25th through May 5th. You can find out more at the website ettyplay.org. Eddie is spelled E-T-T-Y. Just ahead, we'll preview a second act for baby boomers as they hit retirement. Stay tuned.